It is the quintessential blend of commerce and camaraderie. You hire a real estate agent to sell your home. She sizes up its charms, snaps some pictures, sets the price, writes a seductive ad, shows the house aggressively, negotiates the offers, and sees the deal through to its end. Sure, it's a lot of work, but she's getting a nice cut. On the sale of a $300,000 house, a typical 6% agent fee yields $18,000. $18,000, you say to yourself, that's a lot of money. But you also tell yourself that you never could have sold the house for $300,000 on your own. The agent knew how to, what's that phrase she used, maximize the house's value. She got you top dollar, right? Right? A real estate agent is a different breed of expert than a criminologist, but she is every bit the expert. That is, she knows her field far better than the layman on whose behalf she is acting. She is better informed about the house's value, the state of the housing market, even the buyer's frame of mind. You depend on her for this information. That, in fact, is why you hired an expert. As the world has grown more specialized, countless such experts have made themselves similarly indispensable. Doctors, lawyers, contractors, stockbrokers, auto mechanics, mortgage brokers, financial planners, they all enjoy a gigantic informational advantage. And they use that advantage to help you, the person who hired them, get exactly what you want for the best price. Right? It would be lovely to think so, but experts are human, and humans respond to incentives. How any given expert treats you, therefore, will depend on how that expert's incentives are set up. Sometimes his incentives may work in your favor. For instance, a study of California auto mechanics found that they often passed up a small repair bill by letting failing cars pass emissions inspections, the reason being that lenient inspections are rewarded with repeat business. But in a different case, an expert's incentives may work against you. In a medical study, it turned out that obstetricians in areas with declining birth rates are much more likely to perform C-section deliveries than obstetricians in growing areas, suggesting that when business is tough, doctors try to ring up more expensive procedures. It is one thing to muse about experts abusing their position and another to prove it. The best way to do so would be to measure how an expert treats you versus how he performs the same service for himself. Unfortunately, a surgeon doesn't operate on himself. Nor is his medical file a matter of public record. Neither is an auto mechanic's repair log for his own car. Real estate sales, however, are a matter of public record. And real estate agents often do sell their own homes. A recent set of data covering the sale of nearly 100,000 houses in suburban Chicago shows that more than 3,000 of those houses were owned by the agents themselves. Before plunging into the data, it helps to ask a question. What is the real estate agent's incentive when she is selling her own home? Simple, to make the best deal possible. Presumably, this is also your incentive when you are selling your home. And so, your incentive and the real estate agent's incentive would seem to be nicely aligned. Her commission, after all, is based on the sale price. But as incentives go, commissions are tricky. First of all, a 6% real estate commission is typically split between the seller's agent and the buyer's. Each agent then kicks back half of her take to the agency, which means that only 1.5% of the purchase price goes directly into your agent's pocket. So on the sale of your $300,000 house, her personal take of the $18,000 commission is $4,500. Still not bad, you say. But what if the house was actually worth more than $300,000? What if, with a little more effort and patience and a few more newspaper ads, she could have sold it for $310,000? After the commission, that puts an additional $9,400 in your pocket. But the agent's additional share, her personal 1.5% of the extra $10,000, is a mere $150. If you earn $9,400 while she earns only $150, maybe your incentives aren't aligned after all, especially when she's the one paying for the ads and doing all the work. Is the agent willing to put out all that extra time, money, and energy for just $150? There's one way to find out. Measure the difference between the sales data for houses that belong to real estate agents themselves and the houses they sold on behalf of clients. Using the data from the sales of those 100,000 Chicago homes and controlling for any number of variables, location, age and quality of the house, aesthetics, and so on, it turns out that a real estate agent keeps her own home on the market an average of 10 days longer and sells it for an extra 3+% or $10,000 on a $300,000 house. When she sells her own house, an agent holds out for the best offer. When she sells yours, she pushes you to take the first decent offer that comes along. Like a stockbroker churning commissions, she wants to make deals and make them fast. Why not? Her share of a better offer, $150, is too puny an incentive to encourage her to do otherwise. Of all the truisms about politics, one is held to be truer than the rest. Money buys elections. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Michael Bloomberg, John Corzine, these are but a few recent dramatic examples of the truism at work. Disregard for a moment the contrary examples of Howard Dean, Steve Forbes, Michael Huffington, and especially Thomas Golisano, who over the course of 3 gubernatorial elections in New York spent $93 million of his own money and won 4%, 8%, and 14% respectively of the vote. Most people would agree that money has an undue influence on elections and that far too much money is spent on political campaigns. Indeed, election data show it is true that the candidate who spends more money in a campaign usually wins. But is money the cause of the victory? It might seem logical to think so, much as it might have seemed logical that a booming economy in the 1990s helped reduce crime. But just because two things are correlated does not mean that one causes the other. A correlation simply means that a relationship exists between two factors. Let's call them X and Y. But it tells you nothing about the direction of that relationship. It's possible that X causes Y. It's also possible that Y causes X. And it may be that X and Y are both being caused by some other factor, Z. Consider this scenario. Cities with a lot of murders also tend to have a lot of police officers. Let's now look at the police-murder correlation in a pair of real cities, Denver and Washington, D.C., which have about the same population, but Washington has nearly 3 times as many police as Denver, and it also has 8 times the number of murders. Unless you have more information, however, it's hard to say what's causing what. Someone who didn't know better might contemplate these figures and conclude that it is all those extra police in Washington who are causing the extra murders. Such wayward thinking, which has a long history, generally provokes a wayward response. Consider the folk tale of the Tsar who learned that the most disease-ridden province in his empire was also the province with the most doctors. His solution? He promptly ordered all the doctors shot dead. Now, returning to the issue of campaign spending. In order to figure out the relationship between money and elections, it helps to consider the incentives at play in campaign finance. Let's say you are the kind of person who might contribute $1,000 to a candidate. Chances are you'll give the money in one of two situations: a close race, in which you think the money will influence the outcome, or a campaign in which one candidate is a sure winner and you would like to bask in reflected glory, or receive some future in-kind consideration. The one candidate you won't contribute to is a sure loser. Just ask any presidential hopeful who bombs in Iowa and New Hampshire. So frontrunners and incumbents raise a lot more money than long shots. And what about spending that money? Incumbents and frontrunners obviously have more cash, but they only spend a lot of it when they stand a legitimate chance of losing. Otherwise, why dip into a war chest that might be more useful later on, when a more formidable opponent appears? Now picture two candidates, one intrinsically appealing and the other not so. The appealing candidate raises much more money and wins easily. But was it the money that won him the votes? Or was it his appeal that won the votes and the money? That's a crucial question, but a very hard one to answer. Voter appeal, after all, isn't easy to quantify. How can it be measured? It can't really, except in one special case. The key is to measure a candidate against himself. That is, candidate A today is likely to be similar to candidate A 2 or 4 years hence. The same could be said for candidate B. Now, if only candidate A ran against candidate B in 2 consecutive elections, but in each case spent different amounts of money, then, With the two candidates' appeal more or less constant, we could measure the impact of the money.